This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah. وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Japan and South Korea condemned the North over an apparent test fire of a second ballistic missile in less than a week. Iran says the only solution to the problems in Yemen is a political one with the participation of Yemeni parties. And UN rights experts urge the U.S. to close the notorious Guantanamo prison after two decades of unrelenting human rights violations there. Thank you for joining us. Japan and South Korea say Pyongyang has fired an unidentified projectile toward the East Sea. The Japanese Coast Guard says the launch could be a ballistic missile. That's North Korea's second apparent launch in less than a week after its leader, Kim Jong-un, pledged to boost the country's military to counter an unstable international situation. Pyongyang also announced last week that it successfully test-fired a hypersonic missile. The launches come amid standoff between North Korea and its southern neighbors over a host of issues, including U.S.-South Korea joint war games on the peninsula. Our Seoul correspondent Frank Smith elaborates on North Korea's latest missile launch. He says the country has repeatedly test-fired its missiles against the backdrop of U.S. sanctions. Sigalis.
Well, they're not really releasing a lot of information here in South Korea, you know, partly because perhaps they don't know that much. They said in a text message, it's been reported, that they divulged this launch by North Korea that just comes less than a week after North Korea launched a hypersonic glide missile. And also, I think significantly follows one day after a statement from the United Nations condemning North Korea for that previous launch. No mention is the biting U.S.-led sanctions against North Korea that are affecting the country's ability to, you know, battle the coronavirus, import things like vaccines and other medicines to help treat North Koreans, as well as trade for foodstuffs and other items on the international market. And those things need to be addressed and might be behind North Korea's, you know, launches and provoking, hopefully, the international community to respond to what it views as unfair treatment from, again, U.S.-led United Nations measures.
Iran says the only solution to the problems in Yemen is a political one with the participation of Yemeni parties. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdullahian, made the comments during a meeting with spokesman of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Muhammad Abdul Salam, in Oman. He said the Yemeni issue is an internal one and the future of the country should be decided through intra-Yemeni talks. Amir Abdullahian also stressed on lifting blockade and ending the war on the impoverished country. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed and millions displaced since then. The tragedies caused by the Saudi-led war on Yemen are way beyond casualties of airstrikes in the country. The healthcare system there is on the verge of collapse due to a fuel crisis caused by the Saudi detainment of Yemeni oil ships. Dr. Latif Al-Washili has more from Sana'a.
The severe shortage of fuel in Yemen is deteriorating the healthcare system in the country. Yemen's Ministry of Health says the rate of infant deaths has increased amid the severe fuel crisis caused by the continued detention of oil ships by Saudi Arabia.
There is a higher rate of infant deaths we face in our department, especially for children with congenital defects or respiratory infections. These children need intensive care and incubators, but unfortunately, the fuel crisis has caused the suspension of many important medical devices to save their lives.
Health officials here say many intensive care units and emergency rooms had to stop providing services due to the lack of fuel, which has led to the death of more patients, including children. They want the United Nations to intervene and force Saudi Arabia to lift the siege it has imposed on Yemen.
The fuel crisis has caused us many problems, especially with children who need blood transfusions and those with cancerous diseases. We need medical solutions urgently, but the fuel crisis is causing delays, and this makes saving the lives of children difficult. We urge international organizations, especially the United Nations, to do their duty and pressure Saudi Arabia to lift its siege on Yemen.
Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen since March 2015. It has prevented the entry of oil vessels and seized them. This has led the war-torn country to a harsh fuel shortage.
Severe fuel crisis has significantly worsened the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where most people have no access to basic health services. And the chaos caused by the Saudi blockade, Yemeni children have suffered the most.
UN experts are urging the United States to shut down its notorious Guantanamo Bay prison, calling it an ugly chapter of unrelenting human rights violations. More than a dozen human rights experts have voiced outrage at the detention camp still operating in Cuba. They say that 20 years of arbitrary detention without trial accompanied by torture of inmates in Gitmo is simply unacceptable for any government, especially the one that claims to be the defender of human rights. The UN experts describe the facility as a site of unparalleled notoriety and a stain on Washington's stated commitment to the rule of law. They urge the U.S. to close the site, return detainees home, or to safe third countries, and provide remedy and reparation for those tortured and detained arbitrarily. The notorious prison was established in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. California University professor Paul Sheldon Foote sounds pessimistic about a probable closure of the Guantanamo. He says all previous attempts to shut down the facility have failed due to a false idea that someday the U.S. is going to run trials for the detainees.
Before Guantanamo, where were these prisoners? They were in CIA dark sites. Where are the voters complaining about those dark sites in other countries that we operate? And as you noted, President Obama, in his first week in office, had his executive order in 2008, but that fell apart because one of the provisions was, well, we're going to send some of them to the United States and put them on trial in either federal courts or military courts. Oh yeah, that killed it right there. You're really going to trust the court system in this country? And so even though he had a majority in the Senate and the House of Representatives of Democrats, he couldn't push it through because it all fails on this idea that we're going to run trials. What kind of trials could you, where can you get witnesses? Where can you get a jury of peers and so forth? I mean, it falls apart, and they're not willing to send them home.
Staying with news from the United States, where the pandemic is entering uncharted territory. The country is witnessing a dramatic surge, reporting more than 1.1 million additional cases. That's the highest daily total of any nation in the world. This is just part of the picture because many U.S. states do not release data over the weekend, which means the final figure is likely to be even higher. The number of hospitalizations has also hit a new peak. Over 140,000 COVID patients have been admitted to hospitals nationwide. Experts are blaming the Omicron variant for the rise. Concerns over an uptick in Omicron are forcing new lockdowns in China, where local COVID outbreaks are reported in multiple cities. Millions of residents in Anyang will have to stay home after about 60 new infections were detected there. It's the third city in Henan province to introduce restrictions. The new cases in the affected cities are still far lower than in Omicron hotspots such as the U.S. and Europe. But the spread is especially causing concerns ahead of the Beijing Winter Olympics. Meanwhile, Australia has reported 86,000 infections in 24 hours. That's a high figure for a country that's received praise for its success in curbing the disease. The country has seen its total caseload more than double in 2 weeks. A surge in Omicron is straining the national health system there. Kazakhstan has been in the headlines for the past week over protests against fuel price hikes that led to the resignation of the cabinet. Now, the country has a new prime minister. Just a short while ago, the parliament voted to appoint Alihan Smilov as the new premier. President Kasym Tokayev has appointed Smilov to form a new cabinet. He served as deputy prime minister in the previous government that resigned last week when the unrest erupted. The protests were peaceful in the beginning, but they later became deadly and violent. Nearly 10,000 people are now in detention. The Interior Ministry says rioters attacked government buildings in several major cities. The president blames foreign militants, mainly from Central Asia, Afghanistan, and West Asia, for the chaos, calling it a coup attempt. Russia deployed its troops to help restore peace, but Tokayev says foreign troops will be leaving in 2 days. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson faces fresh pressure over breach of COVID rules. A leaked email shows his Downing Street residence hosted a party during the first national lockdown. According to a British broadcaster ITV, the email was sent by one of Johnson's top aides on May the 20th, 2020. It invited over 100 employees to a socially distanced party that evening to, quote, make the most of the lovely weather. Around 40 staff gathered in the Downing Street garden, including Johnson and his wife. At the time, only two people were allowed to socialize outside by maintaining 2-meter distance. Johnson's office has declined to comment on the latest revelation. However, the opposition Labour Party accuses Johnson of having no regard for the rules he puts in place for the rest of the people. As I said earlier, Kazakhstan has named a new prime minister. Mr. Smilov is now actually tasked with the responsibility to form a new cabinet there. To discuss that story further, I'm now joined by Mr. Dmitry Zolotarev, a journalist and political analyst, joining us out of Irkutsk. So first, what do you make of the situation and the unrest and the new cabinet that is going to be formed in Kazakhstan?
Yeah, I see. First of all, Kazakhstan has always been a specific arena of interests for Western policy. So it was a question of time when it was going to happen. So now we witness it happened. So it's not a question what kind of a cabinet is being formed now. The question is how these events will affect the region, what stays behind them, and what do we have in perspective. So I have no doubts that it has been a coup, an attempt to overthrow a government of Tokayev. So maybe by some forces inside Kazakhstan and with big help of forces, you know, from you know where, I suspect that from the United States and the other NATO countries, how it happened in the Ukraine. So it's lines up. NATO presses Russia, comes closer, and Kazakhstan would be a perfect arena for them to get into and to take over. One thing, just if they did succeed, so Kazakhstan would be a bloodbath, much worse than it has been in Ukraine. So it's a good thing that Tokayev showed himself a much better president than Yanukovych a few years back, and other Tashkent Treaty states sent peacemakers to help the government to get things under control. The thing is that we have other countries, other Muslim countries around Kazakhstan, which are always a threat of, I shouldn't say threat, I think, I mean that where the peace might be disturbed from the outside. So, I mean, Kyrgyzstan, for instance, which is quite not really stable politically, and Turkmenistan. So they have to be very careful about what's happening inside the country and to get control over the activities of foreign special forces, which might be, or should I say, which are acting inside the countries. The thing is, there's no doubt for me that everything happened in Kazakhstan was planned in the West, and that was pretty well paid and staged. The thing is, here in Russia, the meanings are pretty different. Some people say that Kazakh elites made some stage of what was happening, and just for as a pretext to invite foreign troops. I say it's total nonsense because all the traits of foreign invasion, or should I say foreign orchestration of a coup, we can see. It's just a little bit different than in Ukraine, and the most different thing is they didn't succeed there, which is really great.
Thank you so much, Mr. Dmitry Zolotarev, a journalist and political analyst, joining us from Irkutsk. Russia warns the United States of a military response to its deployment of advanced weapons in Europe. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov says the Russian response will inevitably harm the security of the U.S. and its European allies. He calls on the U.S. to demonstrate maximum responsibility and do not underestimate the risk of confrontation. Ryabkov was speaking after a day of crucial U.S.-Russian security negotiations in Geneva. He also said that there had been no progress on Russia's proposals to stop NATO's eastward expansion. The U.S. lead negotiator, however, described the talks as frank and forthright. Wendy Sherman said she renewed warnings of the major consequences Moscow would face if it invades Ukraine. Moscow has time and again denied any such plan. Well, that's your world news for now.
what you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight.
When opposing the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Seahawks crowed about human rights. With U.S. sanctions causing starvation? Not so much, says Murtaza Hussein, journalist, in an article published under the heading the silence, or worse, of human rights hawks on U.S. sanctions against Afghanistan. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Month after the U.S.-backed Afghan government fell to the Taliban, ordinary Afghans now face what could be their direst winter in decades. Thanks to the economic collapse that accompanied the U.S. military withdrawal, coupled with the imposition of sanctions and the cessation of much humanitarian aid, millions of Afghans must contend with the very real prospect of starvation. Some will die. Many will lose their lives to preventable death. While limited humanitarian exceptions for trade have been carved out in recent weeks, the World Health Organization has already warned that up to 1 million Afghan children may die as a result of malnutrition over this winter if drastic steps are not taken. Children are already bearing the brunt of the humanitarian catastrophe, punctuated by horrifying stories of kids being sold to pay for food. And the country's notoriously harsh winter is already taking a toll. Afghans are freezing to death as they flee the country with their families. U.S. sanctions policy is directly to blame, pushing Afghans over the edge as they already struggle to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic and the political upheaval created by the collapse of the central government, as Paul Spiegel, director of the Center for Humanitarian Health at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, wrote last December after returning from a trip to Afghanistan on behalf of the WHO. "I can clearly state that if the United States and other Western governments do not change their Afghanistan sanction policies, more Afghans will die from sanctions than at the hands of the Taliban. The deaths will be brought about as a result of deliberate policy decisions made in the U.S. Alongside new sanctions imposed after the Taliban takeover, the U.S. froze nearly $10 billion of Afghanistan's central bank holdings there. The Biden administration refuses to release the funds despite ongoing public protests by Afghans. As all of this plays out, the clamor of voices criticizing the U.S. military withdrawal this summer on humanitarian grounds has gone deadly silent. After the withdrawal, many commentators and political leaders claimed that there was a humanitarian imperative behind the conflict, particularly the protection of Afghan women. Many of the humanitarian and feminist arguments had been used for years to help justify a military occupation that was often despised by the same people it was ostensibly defending. In contrast, ending the current sanctions regime and releasing funds owned by Afghans actually would do something unambiguously positive for civilians there, including women and children who are particularly at risk. The cognitive dissonance on this place perhaps best underlined by Representative Michael McCaul of Texas, the ranking Republican on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. This summer, McCaul decried the fate of Afghan women. "We are seeing this nightmare unfold, unmitigated disaster of epic proportions," he said in an interview, adding, "and what I really worry about the most are the women left behind and what's going to happen to them." When the Biden administration then put sanctions exemptions in place to allow some humanitarian aid, McCaul then turned around to condemn the limited relief, even as news reports describe the economic collapse wreaking havoc on the lives of Afghans, including women and children. With this new nightmare unfolding, the concern shown in August has largely faded. Sanctions are one of the bluntest coercive tools in U.S. foreign policy toolkit and happen to be a favorite of policymakers, even as they rarely produce political results. Afghanistan is just one example of a mindlessly cruel sanctions regime that wreaks havoc on entire civilian populations without accountability. The situation in Afghanistan may yet stand out as one of the deadliest instances of violence against civilians inflicted by U.S. sanctions. The Afghan government that was built over two decades of American occupation was created to be wholly dependent on foreign support, particularly its healthcare system. With the abrupt withdrawal of aid and imposition of sanctions, millions of Afghans, including women and children, are now at risk. More stories of starvation, death from the cold, and families broken apart by economic need are likely to result from the present approach of preventing access to funds owned by the Afghan government and denying aid. And it seems unlikely that such measures will do what 20 years of war could not, build a stable government that keeps the Taliban out of power. Though sanctions on Afghanistan won't achieve U.S. political aims, they are, as in so many other countries, succeeding in visiting cruel consequences upon the most vulnerable. House Democrats have called on Biden to release funds owned by Afghanistan's central bank, but the administration has so far been resistant to do this step. One reason could be that reversing course would reveal the brutality of the underlying policy employing sanctions to deny foreign nations' central banks access to their funds, which the United States government continues to do in other cases. Meanwhile, the broader sanction regime on Afghanistan remains in place, with ordinary Afghans bearing the brunt. To help Afghanistan make progress on the humanitarian front, it is simply not enough to just give aid to Afghanistan. Washington's financial warfare against the country must end, wrote Gregorio Cafiero, CEO of Persian Gulf State Analytics, and an adjunct fellow at the American Security Project, adding, "Those in the West who voice so much concern about the lack of freedom for Afghan women under the Taliban owe to also care about their survival this winter."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Communicate.
It's been 2 years now since the United States assassinated General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis. Both these men were known as formidable tacticians and military commanders, but also revered as national heroes in Iran, Iraq, and the region at large. General Qasem Soleimani was an Iranian general who headed the Quds Force, a branch of the Iranian Revolution Guard Corps, the IRGC. Meanwhile, Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis, an Iraqi, headed Kata'ib Hezbollah and was the deputy commander of the Hashd al-Sha'bi, known in English as the Popular Mobilization Units, or PMU. Both these men played a significant role in defeating Al-Qaeda and ISIS, or Daesh, in Syria and Iraq. They formed an integral part of the axis of resistance and were instrumental in Iran's larger support for resistance movements in West Asia, including the Palestinian resistance and Hezbollah. I wanted to ask the following questions. What did the work carried out by Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis mean for the region? How have things changed since their murder? And did the Americans succeed in their goal of weakening the axis of resistance? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On January 3rd, 2020, a commercial flight arriving from Damascus landed in Baghdad Airport. Aboard the plane was General Qasem Soleimani, who had come on an official visit at the invitation of the then Iraqi Prime Minister. General Soleimani was met by Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Meanwhile, circling overhead were a number of American aircraft. As Soleimani's convoy was leaving the airport, a Reaper drone fired on them, killing Soleimani and Abu Mahdi, along with four members of the IRGC and four members of the PMU. The shock of this incident was immediately apparent. Chris Murphy, a Democratic senator from Connecticut, described Trump's assassination of Soleimani as the equivalent of the Iranians killing the U.S. Defense Secretary.
As to how to manage the fallout that comes from such a drastic action, this is the equivalent of the Iranians assassinating the U.S. Secretary of Defense. If the Iranians were to assassinate the U.S. Secretary of Defense, we would consider that an act of war, and we would respond disproportionately.
Trump knew full well that Iran would respond. How could they not? After all, Soleimani was one of the most important and powerful men in Iran, if not the entire region. The day after the assassination, Trump went on an all-caps tirade on Twitter, saying that if Iran responded, they would be hit, quote, very fast and very hard. He also threatened to bomb Iran's cultural sites, a war crime under international law. No U.S. president before Trump had dared to kill General Soleimani, knowing full well that it would be unjustifiable and could easily lead to war. Soleimani's body was brought to Iran to begin the funeral processions and national mourning. In multiple cities, literally millions of people flocked to the streets to mourn the slain commander. Just take a look at these clips from the funeral processions. General Qasem Soleimani was buried on January 7th in his hometown Kerman. After his burial had to be postponed twice because of how large the crowds were, a testament to his popularity. On January 8th, Iran began Operation Martyr Soleimani. In response to the assassination, Iran sent a barrage of rockets, firing a dozen ballistic missiles at the Ain al-Assad air base in Iraq. This base housed foreign troops, mainly Americans, and is located in Iraq, west of Baghdad. This volley of rockets leveled the base. There were no fatalities, however, it said that scores of U.S. troops were injured, many diagnosed with traumatic brain injuries. Now, the framing of this attack is again very funny, because in the mainstream media, they were asking if Iran was ready to de-escalate the situation, as if Iran had just assassinated a U.S. official. And also saying things like, well, Iran is lucky. They're lucky they didn't kill any U.S. troops when they launched those missiles. Otherwise, we would have responded. Well, no, Iran didn't just randomly decide to launch missiles at the Ain al-Assad airbase for no reason or because they don't like your clothes or your hair. They launched the missiles at Ain al-Assad because you just committed an act of war and murdered an Iranian government official. It is, in fact, the United States who is lucky that Iran didn't do more. Now, the legality of such a strike has been at the center of debate about Soleimani's killing. Donald Trump claimed that Soleimani was planning an imminent attack against Americans. Then Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that killing Soleimani, quote, saved American lives.
It's the right decision. We got it right. The Department of Defense did excellent work. And the president had a entirely legal, appropriate, and a basis, as well as a decision that fit perfectly within our strategy.
It's probably a good time to mention that Mike Pompeo was also the former director of the CIA, where he also did this.
I was the CIA director. We lied, we cheated, we stole. It was like We had entire training courses.
Neither Trump nor Pompeo could provide any evidence to substantiate their claims about Soleimani. At first, they said that there was an imminent threat, but couldn't give a timeline when. They said days or weeks. Then Pompeo said that they had killed Soleimani because of something that happened in the days before the strike. But those are two completely different things. Something cannot be imminent if it's in the past. And it's not hard to see that Pompeo and Trump are lying and had no evidence of any so-called imminent threat. It seems the only reason Trump and Pompeo made this ridiculous claim about self-defense is because it's the only way Trump could legally justify the assassination at home under U.S. law. In 1973, the War's Power Resolution was passed, requiring the president to notify Congress within 48 hours of taking military action. In the Trump administration's legal rationale for assassinating Soleimani, they cited the Authorization for the Use of Military Force of 2002, also known as the AUMF of 2002, which was passed under the Bush presidency for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. This is one of the most extreme, exaggerated interpretations of the AUMF 2002, which, by the way, was authorized against Iraq, not Iran. And nevertheless, that's just U.S. law, not international law. So just because Trump cites the AUMF of 2002, that doesn't suddenly make it okay on the world stage. Remember, the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was a war of aggression and is considered illegal under international law. Trump also claimed that, quote, "The strike against Soleimani in Iraq was taken in the United States' national self-defense, as recognized in Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, in response to a series of escalating armed attacks that Iran and Iran-supported militias had already conducted against the United States." Well, speaking of the United Nations disagrees. Agnès Callamard is the UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial, summary, and arbitrary killings. She concluded the U.S. murder of General Soleimani to be unlawful and illegal under international law. In July 2020, the Special Rapporteur published a report in which she examined the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. She rejected the United States' attempts to justify his murder. She found the U.S. to be in violation of the U.N. Charter and that, quote, "the course of action taken by the U.S. was unlawful." Article 2.4 of the UN Charter forbids the use of force by one UN member state against another. She concluded that the United States broke this law. The examples of imminent threats provided by the US were in fact not imminent, but things that had already happened months before. Some of them were not even actual attacks, but rather perceived threats, while other examples included things like Iran shooting down a US drone that had illegally entered Iranian airspace. Sina Rahmani is a translator, scholar, and writer. His work has appeared in Iranian Studies, Radical History Review, and Public Books, among others. He's also the creator of the East is a podcast that takes a critical look at the history of the present in West Asia and North Africa. I asked him what he thought the motivations were behind the United States assassination of General Soleimani.
So two men represented and were, in addition to their own work as military commanders, effective ambassadors for their cause and their alliances, movers in their own political environments, and sort of the military aspect, and those aspects of their personality, they both were symbols of a resistance to the U.S. imperial agenda in the region that's been unfolding for three decades in different ways and in different backdrops. But they were the symbol of an alliance between certain forces in the region. They named themselves the Axis of Resistance, but whatever name you give to themselves, it's really just a anti-colonial sort of resistance front or anti-imperial resistance front. So that's the kind of general answer. But in reality, I think there are the sort of cold political calculations. I think that at the time we were in the midst of this kind of unfolding crisis, generated essentially at the behest of a highly placed source of individuals who more or less purchased foreign policy, and that was the sort of signature effect of the Trump presidency, is that he was honest in a way. The Saudis and certain factions among Zionists sort of hedged their bets and they invested in this guy. And that paid off in that unfolding crisis in those 2 years. And this was, I don't want to say culmination, but in effect the most dramatic sort of theater of that unfolding drama that was ultimately begun by Washington, begun in those sort of like secret, you know, and unfolded over the course of those 2 years and resulted in the assassination of these two men. Extrajudicial killing, you know, it was totally illegal, and I mean, that's obvious.
I mean, we mentioned these cold, calculated foreign policy decisions on that front. What was the goal? Why were the Americans trying to assassinate Soleimani and Abu Mahdi in terms of foreign policy objectives? And did they succeed? You know, if their goal was to change the Middle East, do you believe that they succeeded in that? And how do you think their deaths have affected the region?
In the sense of, like, you know, cold, hard calculations, nothing changes. I mean, nothing changes in the real. There are these two men played historic roles, yes, but ultimately they were reflections of a system of resistance that's been in production for a long time. And those systems have been tested in the last two decades of cataclysmic war being waged from all corners of the entire sort of West Asian region. And the Iranians emerged. There's a historic development in the last two decades. You know, this has been my adult life, is watching the U.S. empire make this insane, you know, like, cataclysmic leap, you know, of ridiculous proportions, of it's trying to establish its, like, you know, insane goals of regime change. You know, what was it, 7 countries in 5 years or 5 countries in 7 years? The General Wesley Clark thing. This is one chapter in a larger story of unceasing war fought by the U.S. against Iran, against its allies, and against anyone who doesn't want to go about being, taking its place in the supply chain, which is what it wants from ultimately the entire region, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, basically the resistance goes on because it's a whole system of, countering colonialism, imperialism.
I mean, at a certain point, 40% of the U.S. military was surrounding Iran. I mean, think of that. That was the first phase. And then the second phase came their mercenaries for the, you know, which their first class one was ISIS, and then the rest of their allies, their supposed allies. And it was just like this team that rocked up and spent the last 10 years destroying the countries that they hadn't destroyed. And the response to that was what Qasem Soleimani's legacy, and we undercut the value of Abu Mohandas, right? We should obviously sort of talk about that. But, like, both of these men and the forces that they represented and the alliances they represented and what they were, you know, leading members of, but ultimately were part of a larger sort of organism, that represented something historic. That's on the scale of the Spanish Civil War, where you had this fascist transnational alliance, except it was bigger than one country. And the response to it was a popular mobilization of normal people taking up weapons. And that's the legacy of the Hashd al-Sha'abi, in the popular mobilization units, which were not a creation of Iran. It was, in fact, a creation of Iraqi Grand Ayatollah, right? That was Ali Sistani. So there's a lot of silliness when it comes to talking about Iran, and one of the worst things is this totally racist and totally bankrupt Orientalist thing of Iranians are the only ones who control things and the rest are their puppets. I mean, it's like Cold War stuff reinvented.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So we know the excuses provided by the U.S. are not true. The United Nations and a large part of the world reject them. So why did the United States assassinate General Soleimani? The murder of Haj Qasem was part of a string of American hostilities against Iran. Trump quit the nuclear deal in 2018. Then he reimposed sanctions on Iran, crippling its economy, flying drones and bombers into Iranian airspace. Trump and Pompeo claimed that Soleimani endangered American lives. No, he didn't. America endangered its own troops' lives, never mind the people of Iraq, Syria, and others, by invading countries on the other side of the planet. This is not your turf. No one endangers American lives in the Middle East except America. You cannot invade foreign countries and then expect people to just shut up and tolerate being occupied. It's also quite amusing listening to the Western media try to explain who Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes was. They say that he fought against American interests in Iraq, as if the Americans have any business being there in the first place after they invaded and occupied the country. That's like if you're talking about the French resistance in World War II and you say that the French resistance is opposing German interests in France. That's a very funny way to say that someone is resisting a foreign military occupation. Now, the United States claims that Soleimani was a terrorist, but Soleimani was killing terrorists, specifically the ones in Syria, funded and supported by the United States, Israel, and their allies. Soleimani's role in the region was an undeniably important one. Most generals today, whether in Iran or the United States, are unheard of. Most Americans probably have no idea who General Petraeus is, and he's one of the more known military leaders in the U.S. In Iran, with General Soleimani, it's a completely different story. He's a national hero and was known as being charismatic and a general who led from the battlefield, not a desk general who sat comfortably away from the front. The Americans love to pretend that they care about minorities. They pretend to care for the Christians in Iraq and Syria. When Mike Pompeo spoke in Occupy Jerusalem, he claimed that General Soleimani was responsible for killing thousands of Christians across the Middle East. This is one of the biggest lies that has ever come out of Mike Pompeo's mouth, which is really saying something.
Qasem Soleimani, this is the man most responsible for the murder and maiming of hundreds of American soldiers and thousands of Christians across the Middle East.
Neither Soleimani nor Iran has ever killed or targeted Christians in the Middle East. On the contrary, Christians who come from the Middle East, like myself, owe a huge debt of gratitude to General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi, because these men and their troops are the ones who protected Christians from being killed by Daesh. Meanwhile, it is the United States and Israel and people like Mike Pompeo who were funding Daesh and Jabhat al-Nusra and terrorist groups like that, which purposely targeted religious minorities. This is why when Haj Qasem was assassinated, Arab churches in the region held mass for Soleimani and Christians prayed for him. Soleimani is not only dear to the Iranians, but to all the people of West Asia and the Levant who understood the role that he played in fighting the imperialists and their proxies in the region. Dr. Fuad Izadi is an associate professor of American studies at the University of Tehran. His work focuses on United States-Iran relations and U.S. public diplomacy. Izadi has also appeared as a political commentator on various international media outlets such as RT, Sky News, and Al Jazeera. I asked him about the important work General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi carried out in protecting minorities in the Middle East. Well, one thing that isn't really talked about enough is that Haj Qasem, Abu Mahdi, they really helped to protect minorities in the Middle East. Christians, Muslims, you know, everyone alike realized the important role that they played. Even after his death, after Soleimani's death, we saw Christians holding mass for him in churches, praying for Haj Qasem. I mean, isn't that a powerful example, a powerful testament to his defense of all kinds of ethnic groups and religions living in this region, defending them from terrorism and imperialism?
You know, this is something that the Western corporate media has generally censored, the fact that Christians in Syria, the Christians in Iraq, were under attack by ISIS unjustly. Islam does not teach its followers to kill Christians. That's not part of Islamic teaching. And realizing that fact, it was actually Qasem Soleimani that was defending the Syrian people and the Iraqi people, no matter what the religion was. And it was very much true, as you said, that after his assassination, Christians in this part of the world lost someone who was helping them survive attacks by people who claimed to be Muslim, but they were not really following the teachings of Islam. And this very fact is hardly see any coverage of that very fact, because Qasem Soleimani was supposed to be a terrorist. You cannot have a terrorist defending Christian. That's not going to be the frame that Western news media outlets want to present. But there's a lot of hypocrisy when it comes to how the media coverage in this part of the world is actually done. It was Qasem Soleimani that highlighted this hypocrisy throughout his life.
You know, one of the things the United States likes to take credit for is supposedly defeating Daesh. Even until now, they claim that they're in Iraq because they're fighting Daesh. Realistically speaking, does the credit go to the Americans or does it go to Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis? Because a lot of people seem to think that they should take the credit for helping to bring the downfall of Daesh. Do you agree that they had a much more significant role in combating all these foreign fighters, the terrorist groups backed by NATO, and the Arab countries in the Persian Gulf?
Who was fighting terrorism? Qasem Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Iraq. We have numerous accounts of the U.S. actually helping ISIS directly or indirectly. This is something that even some Western sources wrote after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, that the United States assassinated the most important individual in the fight against ISIS. The U.S. talked about fighting ISIS. In a lot of cases, they actually helped ISIS. And the country that fought ISIS, the military commander that engaged in that was Qasem Soleimani. So that's, if somebody's interested in fighting terrorism, somebody's interested in establishing peace, they should look at Qasem Soleimani as a hero.
So in the last weeks, we've seen reports that the Israelis were involved in the attack, or at least they've admitted to being involved in the attack. Trump allegedly said that he felt used by the Israelis. What do you think of that? Do you agree with that assessment that the Israelis used him? And what do you make of the Israeli role in the murder of Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi?
You know, we had a retired Israeli general that just a few days ago said that Israel is doing well. And we had other accounts that actually pointed out that Qasem Soleimani was someone that not only fought against U.S. domination. And overall, you have a situation where Israelis are not actually in a better shape today when you compare their standing now to what happened to when Qasem Soleimani was alive. You remember this a few months ago, we had the resistance in Gaza, in Palestine, actually fighting back.
In the Middle East, General Soleimani is considered a hero because he defeated terrorists like Daesh and Al-Qaeda. In the West, they call him a terrorist because he defeated their proxies, Daesh and Al-Qaeda. If the goal of the assassination was to cripple Iran or hurt Iran's military capabilities, that has obviously failed. Iran is stronger than it was 2 years ago by all reasonable metrics. Look how its military capability has grown and how the regional makeup has shifted in its favor. The United States had to flee Afghanistan. It can no longer sustain its occupation of Iraq. Its war against Syria has failed. If the goal was to demoralize the axis of resistance, that has also failed. The Houthis in Yemen are making huge advances as Saudi Arabia realizes it can no longer sustain this war against them. In Iraq, Soleimani's assassination prompted the Iraqi parliament to vote to tell the Americans to leave. And the Hashd al-Shaabi have become an even stronger force in Iraq, keeping the U.S. occupation on its toes. And while sanctions in Syria continue to take a strong toll, the project for regime change has failed and looks weaker and weaker by the day as Arab countries begin normalizing ties again with Syria. In Lebanon, Hezbollah has brought in fuel and helped to mitigate the effects of the de facto American siege with the help of Iran. And finally, Iran itself is in an even stronger position than it was before. It has more leverage in its nuclear program, a stronger relationship with China and Russia, and deeper ties with its neighboring countries. So by killing Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, did the United States succeed in weakening Iran or weakening the axis of resistance? The answer is clearly no. Iran and the resistance axis, they don't function like the USA or some random country. You cannot just kill one man, one leader, and then think, oh, everything is over. Now, while General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi were certainly formidable tacticians and commanders in their own right, together they formed part of a system, part of the resistance. And you cannot defeat the resistance by simply killing one or two important individuals. Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi played a crucial role. This is undeniable. But the objectives of resisting against occupation, imperialism, and neocolonialism continue. And this is something that will only end with the complete liberation of the Middle East and Palestine. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the Limelight.
By no means has voting blue meant a change for the better. In fact, the only real difference between Biden and Trump in terms of foreign policy is that instead of mean tweets, more respectful language is used to give the new president the veneer of respectability, says Robert Inlakesh, journalist, in an article titled Biden's Diplomacy is Back, Falls Flat as 2021 West Asia Policy, a Miserable Flop. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Despite President Joe Biden having claimed earlier this year that diplomacy is back and that he would end a war in Yemen, revive the Iran nuclear deal, and settle several other issues, in reality, his West Asia region foreign policy has been just as detrimental to the region as was that of his predecessor. This war has to end. We are ending all American support for offensive operations in the